Okay, guys, so last week we started talking about just the word echad, or echav, as you like. Isn't what? It's a the, right? All Dalids are something like that. I think Ray Ginsburg says only for that. Without a Degesh. Yeah. No, obviously. A Dalid like that, meaning without a Degesh. I think Ray Ginsburg said that only for that Dalid he's machbid to a the, because since Chazal say you're supposed to lengthen it, and you can't, right? Okay, halachic point, right? Nobody, right, halachically you're supposed to lengthen the Dalid, right? Which if you say duh is not possible. And if you say echad duh, you're not yotze, because that's not the word, right? Echad duh is another word. I don't know what word it is, but it's not that word. So either just say echad, in case you're yotze, right? Or choose this word of all words to go the, echad. You do it as long as you want. What? It's the th of the, or that, or then, that one, the, right? The right, if you talk to like a Taimani or Moroccan, right, that's the, and the stuff in Ashkenazi is the th, right? The soft one. Okay, anyways. So last week we mentioned Rashi's view that echad is, the way you're supposed to read it is, God will one day be one, right? Meaning, this is not making a theological claim that God is one. It's saying that one day the whole world will recognize God. Right? That was the view. But as we said, there are many views in terms of what is the echadness of this. So let's go through as many as we can get through today. So Roy Lam calls the next one what he calls the comprehensiveness view. What is the comprehensiveness view? So the Gemara in Brachot says, quotes Rabbi Yirmi on the name of Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, which we saw this, who said that he was lengthening Echav, and he said, why are you doing it so long, right? Rabbi Yirmi was going Echav, and he said, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said, what are you doing? He said, once you have declared God king over what is above, below, in the four corners of the heaven, no more is required. So as long as it takes you to think God is king over everything, right? I know that sort of looks like a cross. I didn't mean that, right? All right, like, you know, it's above, below, all around, okay? That's not a cross. That's I don't know what, right? Then that's enough. So Rav Lam says, right, this echad, as the Gemara understands it, is not the one that one day everyone will recognize him as God, which was the eschatological view from last week. This is what he calls the comprehensive view. Right? Echad just means God is the one and only ruler over all that is. Right? That's what you're supposed to be thinking about in Echad. And that's how Rabbeinu Yonah paskens, right? That you should prolong the Dalid until as much time as it takes you to meditate that God is the creator of the world, king above, below, heaven and the earth and the four corners of the world, of your own 248 organs, and if you can't keep so much in mind, then just think that the God who is now our God will one day be one. Right? So Rabbeinu Yonah, what does he essentially do? Both. He says, L'chadchila, you should focus on the comprehensive view of Echad, that God is king over all that is. And if that's too much, because, you know, you get caught up on, oh, the cosmos, well, right, Ginsburg isn't teaching us about quantum mechanics, so I have to think about it. God is king over the quantum world and the non-quantum world, and that just gives me a headache. If you can't handle that, then don't think about what he calls the comprehensive view. Think about the eschatological view, that one day all the world will recognize God as one, and that's good, too. So Rabbeinu Yonah thinks that the primary oneness that we care about, which is the one which is in the simple pshat of the Gemara, right, which is God is the king over all that is. And the secondary one is the one found in the Sifra, which is that God will one day be recognized uniformly by the whole world. But those are both legitimate layers to the word echad in Shema. Now he notes, however, Rambam notes that this is assuming that there's a machloket. But if you look at the girs of the Rif, the Rif's version is a little bit different. I'll read you his English, which is, Rabbi Yirmiyah was one sitting. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said, Rabbi Yirmiyah, why so long? So Rabbi Yirmiyah said, what then is the proper length of meditation? So said Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, so you declare him king over heaven, earth, and the four corners of the world. So what is significant is, the Rif has it not about what are you meditating on, but how long are you meditating, right? So Rambam notes that technically in the Rif isn't making any claim about what you're thinking about. It's just that the amount of time it would take you to think about the fact that God is the king over what's above and below and four corners of the world, whatever that takes you, 3-4 seconds, that's how long you should say echad. What intent you put in that, it might be that intent, it might be a bunch of other intents, whatever you can pack in to 3-4 seconds, right? That's how much you should be doing it, in which case you could argue that it's not telling decisively that you have to think about the comprehensive view. It's just saying that's how much time you get, the amount of time it would take you to think about the comprehensive view. Yes, Jonathan.
If you're going to things like however long you need to meditate on God, whatever, are you saying there's a limit to
how that point, that God is king over all, above and below in the whole world. Right, that's about it.
Okay.
Now, Jonathan brings the next point, is, okay, what exactly does that mean? Right? And this is where there are many different positions that try to figure out what exactly should you be thinking about him. So, he notes, one possibility is what seems to be the Zohar's position, what he calls the, simply, let atar panui mine. There is no place that is empty of him. Right? That is one possibility. He's everywhere. And we'll get to the question of pantheism, panentheism, etc. Okay? Fine. Rif Kook says that what you're supposed to be thinking about is not just that God is in all space, whatever that means, but that God is beyond time. And the way he gets there is this notion that Chet is 7 days of the week, but beyond that. Right, the chet is symbolic of the fact that God is beyond the symbol of time, which is the number 7. Chet. Aleph chet dalet. Right, that echad. Right, that the dalet is the four corners of the world, that God is master of space, and the chet is 7 plus 1, is beyond time. A third interpretation, I'll skip some of his other things, and this is what he notes is the position of the Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Albo, is that Echad, what you're supposed to be thinking about, is not the comprehensive view, that God is king over all, space, time, etc., not the eschatological view, that one day God will be uniformly accepted, but is the, what he calls the exclusivist interpretation, which is, we serve God alone. Right, then that's it. Right, God is the one's sense of levado. He alone is God. Right, he is the only one. He is the only God, and therefore the only one that we serve. That is the point of Echad. Now, I will point out that modern scholars have made a big deal of what they call internal unity and external. Right? An external unity. Meaning, is the focus of Echad that God is the only God? Right? Or that God is one? Right? The Rambam thinks that, and we'll talk about this in a minute, that what does Echad mean? That God is in one sense, right? Yichudo, he's one, he's indivisible. But the Rashbam, the Ezra, and Albo said that's not what you're thinking about during Echad. Echad is simply he's the only God. Whether he is made up of parts is not what's going on here. Right? Echad simply means he is the only God. Or now, there were, right, you could theoretically even have a more minimal one, which is not just he's the only one who is God, but he's the only God I serve. Right? But there might be other gods, right? That would be a problematic read. But that theoretically could be in the word one as well. But the way the Rashbam and Ezra and Albo take it is, God is the only one I serve because he is the only God. Okay, so far we have three interpretations, right? Echad means we're looking forward to the day in which God is uniformly accepted. That's the position of Rashi, and the second position of Rabbeinu Yonah. The Gemara's simple understanding is that God is God over all time, space. And then there's Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Albo, who said, no, what you're thinking about in Echad is God is the only God, and therefore the only one I serve. Okay, that's three things that you should, or three and a half things that you should have in mind when you say the word Echad. Now, the Rambam, right, what is the, now as I mentioned though, the Rambam really has a fourth interpretation, right, which is what? That what is Echad? Not that I only serve God, and not that God is the only God, and not that everyone will one day serve God, but, yes, right, is that it's a theological statement about God, his oneness, okay? No, it's that, because you could say he's the only God, but he has a body. The Rambam says, no, Echad means God's nature is oneness, meaning he's indivisible, right? You could say that he's divisible, but still the only God. I'm not saying, I want to just clarify, I'm not saying Ibn Ezra, Albo, put their name behind that thesis. My point is that's not what they think is happening in Shema, or that that's not what you're thinking about in the word Echad. The Rambam thinks that what he's thinking about in Echad is that God is one in the sense that he's indivisible. Yesod ha-yesodot ve'amud ha-chokhmot leida sheyesh ha-matui rishon. Right? Hilchot Yesod ha-Torah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph. Right? And then the Rambam goes on to say, right, in the following halachot, he is one, meaning he has no parts, ein ichud ka'achduto. There is no other oneness like his oneness. Right? He gets this from this word, echad. Now, what Rilam does very nicely in chapter 8 is that he basically takes the Rambam's view and he places this in the context of what he calls one and contemporary science. Right, this is how he wants to analyze one. So he notes, right, Echad is an issue not only for theologians and religious laymen, but in a non-theistic context for scientists and philosophers as well. In fact, it ultimately concerns all human beings. Indeed, although starting out from totally different vantage points, religious and scientific considerations of unity run parallel. Both acknowledge unifying forces in the universe and perhaps beyond it. In this chapter, we'll briefly discuss that the concept of divine unity is refracted through two lenses of modernity. First, we'll consider how contemporary physicists now view the natural universe. Then we'll turn to the question of the psychocultural orientation of modern society and its relation to God. Yeah. He writes, Albert Einstein, after successfully developing his revolutionary theories, the special and the general theories of relativity, next turned his attention to discovering the underlying pattern of the entire universe. Seeking a single theory that would embrace all physical phenomena, from the cosmic to the subatomic. That ambition to formulate a theory of everything has so far proved elusive. Einstein died before he could find the greater unified field theory of physics that could account for the four forces of nature, gravitation, electromagnetism, and both the weak and strong nuclear forces within the atom. That unified theory has not yet been discovered, although proponents of superstring theory have recently made claims for such a unifying concept within their models of the universe, many physicists are skeptical. This quest remains central to legions of nuclear physicists. Like the Jewish monotheistic intuition that one absolute simple creator is responsible for both the creation and governance of nature, modern scientists instinctively believe that a fundamental unity underlies all natural phenomena. Right, so Lamb very sharply points out that essentially the Maimonidean notion of one, right, which is that godliness is about indivisibility, is in fact what lies behind the obsession with physicists with things like string theory, the theory of everything, that the world can be described in one theorem. And at some level, what Rylam is picking up on is that that is an attempt to see the universe in the way that the Rambam saw godliness. Now, he notes, not all physicists share that conviction, right? And not all people think there is a cosmic unity in that sense. And they're perfectly fine saying there's physics at the subatomic level, and there's rules at the non-subatomic level, or as I know Ginsberg mentioned to you on Thursday, the physicists who believe that the reason that we're failing in making breakthroughs in science is because we believe there's such a thing as rules at all, right? But what Rylam notes is it may not be legitimate to make this analogy, right, between creation and the creator, but this instinct in many modern physicists to look for not just explanatory theories of the universe, but a single theorem that explains all of creation is, in some sense, what the Rambam believes is God. That what's unique about God is that he is one, even more than one explanatory theory. But what he's pointing out is that this belief that the most perfect thing, right, would be something that is totally unified is essentially the way the Rambam believes God to be in the extreme. And that's what he thinks is going on in the world, in the word Echad. And he notes that this Sajagon and the Rambam both sort of take this, but in slightly different ways. Right, Sajagon writes as follows. Inasmuch as the creator of the universe, exalted and magnified be he, is essentially one, it follows by logical necessity that his creatures be composed of many elements, as I've made clear in the foregoing. At this point now, I would say that the thing that generally gives the appearance of constituting a unity, whatever sort of unity it be, is singular only a number. Upon careful consideration, however, it is found to be of a multiple nature. Reduced to generation to simpler terms, with the substances of all beings are analyzed, they are found to be endowed with the attributes of heat and cold and moisture and dryness, etc. All these phenomena are in accord with the laws of creation, namely the creator exalted and magnified be he, be one, and his works manifold. Right, so Rav Sajagon says that he agrees with the Rambam about God's oneness, but what does he think? That only God gets that oneness, and creation, dafka, doesn't. Right? That in the end of the day, the whole point is that God is one in that sense, and the rest of existence is not. However, the Rambam, on the other hand, writes, no, that the whole of being is one individual and nothing else. I mean to say that the sphere of the outermost heaven, with everything that is within it, is undoubtedly one individual, having respective individuality the rank of Zayd and Umar. This is from the Moreh. The differences between his substances, I mean the substance of this sphere, with everything that is within it, are like unto the differences between the limbs of man, for instance. Just as Zayd, for example, is one individual, same time composed of various parts of the body, such as the flesh and the bones of various mixtures of several spirits. The sphere in question as a whole is composed of the heavens, the four elements, and what is compounded by the latter. Accordingly, it behooves you to represent to yourself in this fashion the whole of this sphere as one living individual in motion and possessing a soul. For this way of representing the matter to oneself is most necessary and most useful for the demonstration that the deity is one, as shall be made clear. Right, so the Rambam actually believes the opposite. He doesn't think that God's oneness is like the universe is, but he thinks the fact that God is one, in that sense, means that existence should mimic that, and he actually did believe that at some deep level, the world, the universe was of one force. It was one organism. So, what Roy Lam points out is that the fourth interpretation of Echad is the Rambam and Rav Sajagon's notion that God is one and indivisible. But the question of what that tells us about the world is different. For the Rambam, at some level, the fact that God is one in that sense means the world should at least mimic that and should be explainable as one organism, maybe even one theorem. For Rav Sajagon, what you learn is, no, only God is one in that indivisible sense, and therefore, the rest of creation, you shouldn't even be looking for unity. The greatness of God is that a one in the indivisible sense of the word, one, created a world which is dafka manifold. But that, exactly, that only God is indivisible and everything else is very, very divisible, right, by definition. Now, both of them will agree that God is one in a different way than the rest of the universe is. But the question is, how much of that oneness do they think the rest of the world should partake in? For the Rambam, creation is great when it's in some level unified, because it partakes of oneness, even though a different oneness. For Sajigon, the point is, no, God is one and indivisible, and his greatness is that from one indivisible God, the rest of the world is dafka, manifold, and distinct. Then he goes into, okay, before I go into what he says after this, so let's summarize what we've seen. Now we've seen four interpretations of one, okay? Rashi's view, one day God will be uniformly accepted. The Gemara, God is the one controller of all time, all space, etc. The third view is God is the only God, or the only one I serve. Fourth view is God himself, his essence, is oneness. And then 4b is, now what does that tell us about creation? The Rambam is God is one in a unique way, and the rest of the universe is still one in a different way, but that's part of his greatness, that it has a unity to it. And Rav Sajagon is, no. One, God is one indivisible, and his greatness that he's indivisible, and the rest of creation is not like sort of divisible, it's greatness in the fact that it is manifold, right? That there it is not one, right? That God created many. So that is four, right? The fourth one that you're supposed to be thinking about. What? Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. Now, the Rabbi Lam, though, contemporary notes that in some level, he writes, one contemporary writer pointing to the contradictory and fragmented quality of modern life, its multiplicity and diversity, concludes that such erosion of our sense of cohesion and unity is inevitable in contemporary society. The more sophisticated we become, the more aware we are of the enormous complexity of nature of human beings, of the mind, of life in general. The more sensitive we are to the vast variety that abounds in the world, the more do we identify with the trees and not the forest. As William Butler Yeats said in his powerful poem, The Second Coming, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Okay. And he notes that people feel like the world is basically, right, chaos. And skipping ahead, he says, in this milieu of incohesiveness and fragmentation, Judaism bids us recite the Shema. If, and this is important, if we assume that the theological of unity of God reflects the existential unity of humanity, then we must understand the Shema's message of God as a chad, as a beckoning vision, not as a description of current reality. The unity of God is unquestionably not yet a fact and must await its defray maintained eschatological fulfillment. But that fulfillment must not be merely a passive one, relegated only to the heart. If not yet a fact, it must be championed as a value, etc. The disparity between what is and what ought to be, between fact and value, between the Lord, our God, is one. And on that day, the Lord will be one, and his name, one, implies a certain tension. If we are called upon actively to help realize the future, how can we declare that God is one? And he goes on, right? And he says, right, that really we should be taking all these interpretations, right? That at one level, we should be taking the God is one in our belief in God to give us a grounding point in the world. But on the other end, we should feel that the world is fragmented. And in that sense, we should identify with the Sifrei's vision that there is a oneness that has yet to come that we should help bring about. Right? So for contemporary readers, what Rylam suggests is, right, to meld these ideas together. To the one hand, say that even in this chaotic world, God is the only one I serve. God is one in a way that nothing else is one. But also to take the Sifrei's view, which is, but there's a way in which we're praying for a future in which God will be accepted as one, and say there's certain things about my current life that are one and indivisible, right, and indivisible, and keep me focused. But the fact that I also feel that the world is fragmented and chaotic is where the Sifrei's vision comes in, that I should say not just that I believe that God is one, but that I commit to making it that God will be one in those other senses, and the world will become unified. And the greatness of Shema is that it allows us both to reflect on the current unified theories of the world, right? The current things in reality that are unified, that are constant, that are unique, that I serve, while also recognizing the fragmented nature of reality and committing myself to building a world which is more one, where God is more one than it currently is, right? And I think he's right. Right, that the greatness of Shema is that it means multiple things, some of which commit to current realities and some which point ourselves to the future. Okay, the last set of interpretations in one, and then we'll be finished with one, and we'll actually finish the first pasuk.
Yay!
Is the Kabbalistic interpretations, the different mystical approaches. And he notes here that one, that in one Kabbalistic view you have to know is, as I said, who here says L'shem Yichud before any of your mitzvot? So L'shem Yichud is the Kabbalistic view that God is not yet one, right? That you have to unify the sphera of Yesod with the sphera of Shechina, one which is male and one which is female, right? Masculine and feminine. And l'shem yichud kudsha b'richo shinte is by doing mitzvot, we actually unify the male part of God and female part of God, right? The nukba and the zuchra. What? I don't know. I'm just telling you that that's what it means. So that's one view thing that comes up in terms of echad. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi and Rav Chaim Volozhin, so one of the greatest of the Hasidic thinkers and the greatest of the Misnagdish thinkers, think that what Echad means is that nothing else truly exists. Right? The Echad is God is the only one and everything else is an illusion. Right? In an extreme version, this is like panentheism, right? That God is in everything and therefore he is all that exists and all else is an illusion. Right? So that is one Kabbalistic possibility. What? Now he goes into what does this mean if the world isn't real and it's all God, so what are you supposed to do? Right? Fine, and then he's so he says that basically, for Kabbalists, though, there is a dichotomy. There's a belief that God, Echad actually means two different things. One is that at the higher level, God is in the truest sense one. But in the lower sense, we actually have to live the world as if it wasn't one and work towards unifying God. And Echad means two things at the same time. Is it means that God in his ultimate essence is one in the Maimonidean sense, but in the way that we're supposed to live in this world, we're supposed to view God as not yet one, and therefore we have to work towards unifying, right, the Shem Yichud Kutshabrichu U Shchente. And therefore, in Kabbalah, we, right, essentially are working on both of these. Okay, I won't get into all the Kabbalistic things. So let me summarize the five visions of Echad that we've seen. I think if I go more into the Kabbalah, you are going to be way too confused. So here are the five interpretations of Echad, which Israelam notes can all, in certain sense, be true. Okay, again, let's summarize. Rashi's view, Rami, let me just go through it. Rashi says Echad means it's about a commitment to the future, that one day God will be uniformly recognized by the world. That's what Echad means. Okay? Two, God is God over everything. Three, God is the only God. 3b, the only one I serve. Four, God is ultimate oneness. Okay? That's why I said that would be 3b. It might mean both, right? But theoretically, Echad could mean both. Traditional Jewish thinkers think it means he is the only one I serve because he is the only God, right? But theoretically, it means both, right? That's why I said 3b. Yes, I understand. I understand. Now, the Ramban would tell you, yes, there are other Elohim, small g, right? There are all other gods, small g, Ramban. Not the Rambam. Meaning, that the Ramban is a complicated theory where he thinks other nations are actually given other gods, small g, to serve, in a certain sense. It's a little bit complicated. It's a little bit complicated. They're not, like, they're small g gods. They're not god gods, but they're powers. Anyways, that's 3b for, 1 second, is that 3 or 4? Right? Okay. 4 is the Rambam, which is God is indivisible. And 5 is that we actually have to work to unify God himself. So now let's go to caveats, right? Is within version 4 that God is one, meaning indivisible. Rabbi Lamb notes that there's really a subdivide, though. God is indivisible, but what does that tell us about the world? For the Rambam, it means that the world, while not indivisible in the way God is, should have an underlying string theory, essentially, right? The closer that the world is to being indivisible, the more godly it is. Rav Sadia Gaon, we learn the opposite, which is the more that God is one, the more you believe that the rest of creation is not one in that sense. Okay? And on level 5, the Kabbalistic view, it's really, Echad means two things at once, which is you simultaneously believe that God at the highest level is really one in the Maimonidean sense, right? But in the lower sense, which whatever that means, the way we relate to him, right? In Kabbalah, it's the Ein Sof, essentially, which is the infinite, right? But Ein Sof is via negativa, like Rambam. We only know that he isn't finite. And then there's the Sfirot one, where we work to unify God and make him Echad. So you at the same time have to believe that God in his essence is indivisible, but God in the way we relate to him is actually divided and we have to unify, right? At the same time. Okay? So that's 5. And Roy Lamb notes that the, first of all, you should believe multiple of them, right? All these are valuable, but also what he says is that what's interesting about Echad from a contemporary perspective is that on the one hand, when everything things chaotic, on the one hand, you commit and you state God is one, there is something that anchors me, oneness. Simultaneously, if you follow the eschatological view of Rashi, quoting the Sifrei, you also say, but at the same time, I'm committing to bringing oneness for the world, right, where the world is more perfected and follows God. So you can, right, Shema is both a time to say, despite the chaos in the world, there's something that grounds me in oneness, but also committing yourself to the future of bringing about a oneness. Right? And the fact that Echad means multiple things allows you to carry both of them in the word Echad. So that is our 5 interpretations of Echad. We have finally actually gotten to the end of the first Pasuk. Right? What? Yes. And then next week we will then pick up on either Baruch Shem or Bahafta. We talked a little bit Baruch Shem, maybe we have to talk about it more. I don't know. I'll figure it out. One of those.